I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. We're here to make psychology understandable, interesting, enlightening, and hopefully we're going to give you some tips for yourself, your family, and your friends to make your life a little bit easier. Today, since we're going to be going, and the topic is forensic psychology in mass shootings in the United States. Since this is a really hot topic right now, we're going to open it up for the callers and to make comments, ask questions. The number is 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. My guest today is Dr. Deborah Warner, and I'd like to give you her background information. Dr. Warner received a Master of Art and Master of Education in Counseling Psychology from Columbia University Teachers College. After graduating, she began consulting and provided individual therapy to chronically mentally ill patients who were involved in the legal system. Her professional assignments include Silmar Juvenile Hall, California Mentor, the Sycamores, Psychological Support Services, Phoenix Programs, IYC, St. Charles, and Regional Center. In 2004, she completed her doctorate in forensic psychology from Alliant University. She went on to work with methamphetamine patients as a psychologist for the University of California, Los Angeles, Department of Family Medicine. She has been an adjunct faculty for University of Phoenix, California State University in Dominguez Hills, Antioch University, Westwood College, and Southern California Institute of Technology. She also served as assistant professor, lead faculty for Chapman University's Marriage and Family Therapy Program. She's currently the lead faculty for the Los Angeles campus of the Chicago School's Forensic Psychology Program. Dr. Warner is a licensed psychologist, and her major areas of interest are student-focused teaching and application of therapeutic tools that can be utilized in multiple forensic settings. She also has begun a private practice and is a contracted consultant for the Department of Homeland Security, where she serves as a lead psychologist. Welcome, Dr. Warner.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Hi, thank you for being here. Now, with this hot topic that we are embroiled in on a weekly basis in this country through the media, in your opinion and research, what are the main reasons multiple murders are increasing in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, there's lots of reasons, you know, why things are increasing in the U.S. What's interesting is that single murders are decreasing, and you have more mass shootings that are happening in the United States. So, I mean, you have to look at what's the motive behind it. Why are people thinking that way? Why are people doing that? You know, and what's our climate and environment, and what's going on in our society? You know, so when you think about it that way, I mean, things have changed, right?
Right.
And years ago, it used to be one-on-one. You would go and you'd harm someone because of something that they kind of land that you thought they had or something in their environment that you wanted. And now, you know, it's about some sort of goal because our society has changed and messages we send to our youth has changed. I mean, we have violent video games. We have movies. We have, you know, become more laxed or liberal in our thinking in a lot of ways. And so it has caused people to go down different paths due to our involvement. And so then people get attention or think about conquering some of their goals in different ways. And now we have these mass, you know, killings or these mass shootings or these, you know, mass things of homicide. And it's fascinating because we need to look at what's going on around us. I mean, we also have unemployment at a low, you know. And so when you have unemployment and you have people out of work, you have people who are idle. You know, one of the things I tell people is when you're working with inmates is they have a lot of time to think. And when you have people with a lot of time to think, they come up with more creative things to do. And you have less time because maybe you're employed or maybe you have other things in your life. And so that causes a lot of different problems in society that you don't even think about and you don't even think to look for or look at.
Right. And I would imagine, too, that the increase in crime shows just on general TV alone, you know, it makes it sort of fascinating, doesn't it, in a way? I mean, I don't watch many of those shows because I just don't have the time right now. I'm finishing up in school, but it's interesting how much thought process they put into beefing up these stories. Now, in your opinion, how true is that, the media portrayal of forensic psychology and just murder in general?
Well, I mean, those are two separate questions, but yet they're fused in a way. But the media is going to do what's sexy. They're going to do what's going to entice you. They're going to do what brings you in. There are a lot of shows that are pretty accurate and true to form in a lot of ways. But there are a lot of things that I look at and I say, that would just never happen, or no one would ever do that, you know? And so it's fascinating to me. Like, there's a really good movie out there, Flight, with Denzel Washington, and at the end, the guy takes responsibility for being an alcoholic. And I'm sitting there and I'm watching it, and he takes responsibility because they're getting ready to blame the alcohol he drank on someone else. And I was thinking about it from an addictive perspective and an addictive mind. So an addict would never have done that, or a normal person probably wouldn't have taken responsibility at that point after everything he'd been through. They probably would have, because the way they answer the question would be, I don't know. They wouldn't have just come clean at that moment. And so that was really inaccurate. If they had maybe asked a psychologist or asked someone who's been through that, they wouldn't have done that. So to come back to your question, when they portray murder on TV, I mean, no one probably has access to go ask a murderer, would they do that? I know the FBI does things like that, but the layperson making a movie probably wouldn't have access to that. Mm-hmm. But they do try to do as good of a job as they can. I do have an old college professor who actually consults for one of the Law & Order shows, and he tries to make those very, very accurate. And when I do watch those, I do see some accuracy in, you know, some of the portrayal. The one, Law & Order SVU, has Dr. Wong on there, and he is very accurate in how he portrays some of the things he does, because I did a lot of that for the Homeland Security or for the police department or things like that. And, you know, especially for the correctional system, I mean, just looking at, you know, categorizing someone in, you know, what's best for them and what's best for their interest, and trying to make sense of the law and, you know, psychology for the courts. Now, that is very accurate on that show. Other shows, not as much.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good to know that at least there's a little bit of truth in fiction out there, you know?
Yeah.
Yes. So now, you were mentioning before the FBI statistics. Do you have any of the numbers as to the increase of mass murders in this country?
Not exactly on mass murders, but what I was looking at was the decrease of basically of individual homicides versus, you know, mass murder homicide, and that has increased. You know, I think I want to tell you it was like by 10.2%. You know, people are doing more mass murder stuff than they are doing, you know, single homicides, which is very fascinating when you look at that, about how many people that is. That's a lot. That's a lot of people, and that's a lot of, you know, people having ingenuity and going into changing, you know, how they're committing murders. And that's kind of frightening. But you also have to look at what's the motive. What's the motive behind it? Is it money? Is it sex? Is it religion? Is it, you know, political freedom? What is the motive? And I think as our society's changing, our motives change, and maybe that's why people are doing more targeted things of getting more people than they're doing it more one-on-one.
And What would you say is one of the top motives for committing a crime so heinous?
You know, I mean, looking at what's out there, I can't tell you some of it's mental illness, because some of it is just way too focused to be someone who's completely psychotic. Some of it could be attention. Some of it could be that people, you know, want people to pay attention to a certain issue. You know, like the person who died in England, and, you know, the Muslim guy who killed him, you know, that was, he wanted people to look at this issue, what was going on, you know, in his country and what's going on in general. So the motives are completely different than that, where you have, you know, other shootings and shooting a school. What was behind that, you know, and people are trying to dissect that. The only people who really know the answers are the people who did it. But we can look and learn from you know, how our society is going and what's going on and how to change things. You know, I think Columbine was a very, you know, one of those moments in time that people stopped and says, whoa, our world is changing. And why is our world changing? You know, why are our teenagers changing? Why would that happen? Let's look at the signs. Let's look and dissect it so we can learn and stop these things. And that was one of the things that happened. So I think we need to stop and do that with each of these things so that maybe we can try to prevent it. But sometimes you can't. Sometimes it's so thought out and calculated that you can't, but you can at least try.
Right. And you do have to look at the calculated planning that these murderers mm-hmm. do. I mean, it's just, you know, we had those mass shootings in Santa Monica not long ago, only a few weeks ago. And again, you know, when the law goes and checks out the apartments, it's always, you know, all this materials, all these guns and ammo and everything else behind it. You know, it's amazing that there's so much planning that goes into this. So you have to kind of question, at what point does the person decide to do this and then start, you know, making all the purchases? It's bizarre.
Yeah, and what's the trigger? That's the thing, is that, you know, when I'm in the classroom and I'm trying to get people to understand, you know, how some of these things happen, I try to break it down to everybody is capable of anything. What was the moment in time that set off the switch? And what was the moment in time that your switch could not turn off? Mm-hmm. You know, anybody in any given circumstance, you know, if something happened, will fight for their life. The difference is that person who can walk away and not kill the person because their switch turns off. What is that for a person to where that switch was turned on, to where they buy the chemicals, to where they buy the guns, to where they go in the elementary school? You know, what was it that turned on the switch where it didn't turn off? And that's the difference in most people, is being able to turn off that switch.
Mm-hmm. So has forensic psychology come up with any kind of theories behind that switch turning on and off?
You know, I don't even know if it's just forensic psychology. I think MSTs, I think clinical psychology, I think counseling psychology, I think we're all trying to figure it out
Yes. Together.
It is such an issue right now with many people that everybody's scared. You know, everybody is on high alert, and it has to do with something going on in our society. I'm very, very confident in that. And whatever has changed from people crossing that line of what is a societal norm to what's not a societal norm and having these more mass killings and murders is something we really need to examine. You know, I will tell you that out here in Los Angeles, I do a lot of work with the Federal LA, and I do a lot of work with community intervention. And a guy named Akil Bashir, part of the PCITI, we do a lot of community intervention with ex-gang members and people who were a part of that lifestyle to stop a lot of these problems that are happening in the street. And he does this program to where he teaches anyone who'll come in, lay people, he teaches officers, he teaches firemen, he teaches people like me, he's social workers, and just regular citizens who want to protect their neighborhoods in the inner city. And what he does is he looks at all the signs that are in the environment, and he teaches you to notice those signs, but he also helps you interact with the police, so the police are not this scary thing. You're actually working with them to help keep your neighborhood safe. And what he's done is help them empower themselves to stop some of the violence within their neighborhoods. And it's amazing. And I just think if people could do that, you know, and on a major scale everywhere, not just the inner city Los Angeles, do that everywhere, things could change, because you're looking in your environment for what the threats are. You're looking in your environment for what the problems are. And you're standing up as just a human being saying, I live here and I don't want this. I live here and let's change this together. I don't care who you are. I don't care what background you have. We're all working together. And it's an amazing thing. There are people from all different walks of life in there who are standing for the same cause. And it's amazing to see, because people don't want to do that. They want to segregate themselves and still want to stereotype. And if people would just pay attention to what's around them, we're all want the same thing. You know, we just have to decide to make that choice.
Right. And that's a fantastic program to have in place. And now, what community is that in again?
It's in Los Angeles.
Okay.
California.
Do you know if there's any other programs that are based off of that? Because, I mean, that would be a fantastic thing to just have in general, to just teach people skills that they need to be more alert of their environment when they go out, especially, you know, like at the Boston Marathon, you know, when you're in a large crowd of people, there's certain things, certain signs that you should be aware of and not second guess or just, you know, go, oh, okay, well, that's kind of weird, but, you know, we'll just walk away and we'll just continue to watch the people running past, you know. So, I think more community programs like that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, he's part of Maximum Force Enterprises, and he actually went to Africa. He's gone to Seattle, Washington. You know, he goes to different states, but, you know, and different countries. But what is fascinating is that each particular place he goes wants what you just talked about. They want the same thing, and they want to empower themselves and empower the neighborhood. And then the one thing they always usually say is that they want to keep their kids safe.
Right.
You know, and that's what it comes down to, is keeping the next generation safe. You know, and that's the survival of the fittest thing, because you want your next generation to go on. And so, you know, it's fascinating to see that everybody's speaking the same thing around the world. You know, it's just that we all need to start believing that that's what we want, and not segregate ourselves because of things that are, you know, really external factors, you know?
Right, because, I mean, in reality, you know, we can protect ourselves to a certain degree, but we just, again, have to just be more alert. So, yeah. Now, in your classes, are you going through the biological basis of what makes a murderer?
I don't really teach profiling in that way. That's something specialized that comes from the FBI. What I do in classes is I really get people, I teach psychopathology and clinical interviewing and courses like that, and my favorite one is diversity. And I'm really working with the students to understand what, you know, really dysfunctional behavior looks like and what that continuum of abnormal is, and then how to apply that to help the person get better, but also know what the warning signs are, know what the red flags are. And when you can start seeing those, you can really help a client. And a lot of people ignore the red flags. And so I give vignettes, I give different film clips, and I say, okay, now let's look at what they didn't say. And then I tell them the other half of the story, and they're like, oh my goodness. And that helps people really understand when they're working with clients therapeutically what to do. But also, I say, now apply this to your life, because what I want them to do is to start living and breathing a lot of this stuff, so when they're in life and when they're in a forensic setting, they keep themselves safe. And that's a way to go about it, so that people really understand psychology and understand psychology is a help and it's not a fear, but also it can actually help you understand the little nuances in your environment to help your client get better.
Right. And what are some of those red flags to be looking out for in a person that might seem a little unstable?
Well, the first one I always tell people is to look at is differences of when you see them from one week to the other. So if they come in and they're completely immaculate, and then slowly they come in and they, and I'm exaggerating this, but they go in and it's one of the weeks they come in and they look like a homeless person and they look like they haven't showered. That's decompensation. That's someone who's really struggling and is decompensating. Their functioning has changed. Or if you hear someone talk to you and they talk to you and, you know, they're married, they have kids, they have a dog named Spot, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, their dog dies. And then they come in a few weeks later and, you know, their parents have decided not to talk to them. And then they tell you they're getting divorced. This is someone who is really decompensating in their interpersonal relationships, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're waiting for the next shoe to drop. Maybe they lose their job. Something is going on. So you really want to look at those things that are just patterns that are coming out. I had one client, you know, that come in, you know, that fictitiously, but they say they come in and they have they look one way, and then every time you see them in a certain outfit, you know something, a shoe has dropped, because they don't care about their appearance. Or they don't talk to you that day, and it's only when, you know, maybe they're wearing a particular thing. Pay attention to those little nuances. They're talking to you without talking to you.
So you need to watch out for the nonverbal changes first, correct?
Not for even verbal stuff, but that is just more salient. A lot of times people don't want to air their dirty laundry at you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you can pay attention to that, that's going to tell you what to ask for.
Hmm.
Or ask the question to get to it.
Okay, so if this was to happen to, like, one of our listeners, somebody close to them started displaying this, what could you recommend something that they could do for the next step with dealing with a person who's decompensating?
Well, I would, you know, listen to what they've told you. Listen to what they've said. You know, especially if they start saying, you know, things that just don't make sense. But I would say, what do you mean by that? Like, what are you trying to tell me? And in no way should you try to intercede yourself, especially if you feel scared or, you know, you definitely could, you know, tell them to get evaluated. And if you really feel they're going to do something, it's better to be safe than sorry. And I would definitely call 911. I would contact an emergency room. I would tell someone what's going on, what you're seeing, and ask a professional for help. You know, if you feel that there's someone's in danger, you can suggest they go for therapy. You can take them to the therapy appointment. You can, you know, talk, if they're in a school and they're a teenager, you can go to the school and say, do you have any resources for me? Like, there's lots of people who are trained in what to do. I mean, especially if they're a kid, a school has loads of resources that people don't even tap into. And just saying something without feeling like there's stigma or pressure is helpful, and a lot of times they don't realize that they're there to help you. Just calling someone, you know, in the phone book cold and ask questions. You know, we definitely are here to help you and answer your questions. And so that's something you can do. But reaching out is the best way, and not trying to handle it all on your own, because you can't. Lots of people saw signs, and lots of people that have done things like this, and they didn't say anything. They just ignored it because they're like, well, I don't want to hurt their feelings, or I don't want to get involved. Not getting involved can cause problems down the road. So asking questions or talking to people, not keeping it a secret, that actually helps a lot.
Yeah, that's very important. I agree, definitely, because the person is in crisis and needs somebody to help him or her go and get the appropriate help so that they don't go and commit these crimes. Definitely. So is there any typical thought processes behind, like, the typical murder?
Excuse me?
Is there any typical thought processes within research, or briefly, of what makes a murderer?
That is such a huge question. It depends on what they want to murder for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have your crimes of passion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have your calculated murderers. But, you know, usually people in crimes of passion are all of a sudden, you know, you catch your wife in bed with another man and you kill the man, or, you know, you things get out of hand, right? You're fighting with your wife and things get out of hand, or your husband, or you stab him because you've had years of being in a domestic violence relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you have that stuff happen, or you even calculate the murder of your wife's lover. That's different, you know. But people who are calculating a murder for other things like wealth or control or, you know, taking over someone's life or taking their identity, those are different motives, and each motive is very different in what you want to do. And so, you know, to say this person's going to be a murderer or this person's going to do this, it depends on really what it's about and what it's about for that person. We're all made up differently. Even people who are, you know, serial killers, why they do what they do is so vastly varied, that's really hard to say,
mm-hmm.
You know.
What would, now, are there any like stereotypes of murders? I mean, because a lot of times I've been hearing lately, well, he was a really quiet person and he was to himself and we never thought that he was going to commit a crime like this and everybody's in shock. I mean, that seems to be a typical pattern. Am I correct?
I see what you're saying. I hear that in the news, like when Columbine happened. Well, they were always to themselves and they wore black trench coats and, you know, they always brought that up and I'm going, that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, okay, I have a black trench coat. Like, so, I mean, you can't put it on one thing, you know. I mean, everybody is type, and there are different, you know, if you have a, you know, access to personality disorder, you're going to have a certain type that goes with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, to say that everybody who is this type is quiet and going to murder people is not it. But you might hear that these particular people in the media and what you've heard have done these crimes. Okay, in that little pocket. But what about all those ones you didn't hear about?
Right.
And so I wouldn't say just everybody who's quiet and recluse turns into that. But, you know, people categorize naturally. People categorize because they want to make sense out of things. And that's just human nature, wanting to make sense out of something that really makes no sense to them or why you would do that.
Exactly. So what would you, what do you think is one of the most important aspects of people understanding calculated murders?
That's a really tough question. I mean, I don't even know if you really can understand it completely because it's really internalized and most people wouldn't go down that path, but you have to, like I said before, understand that everybody can do everything if they're given the right set of circumstances and the right, you know, hot buttons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to realize what was the situation that caused that to happen and then look at it from, try to look at it from that perspective of why they did what they did. Like, everybody's born into a certain circumstance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so some people are born into high privilege and some people are not, and some people are born in the middle. But that doesn't mean that you have all good things in your environment that could have shaped you. And it doesn't mean you have all bad things. There are people with everything going right in their lives and they go and do these things, right?
Right.
But you have to look at certain circumstances might influence certain things for things to happen. And you look at patterns of behavior, and sometimes we're social learners, and we learn from what's around us, and some people don't learn from what's around them. But sometimes people take on those traits. So you have to look at, okay, this person has this set of circumstances. They may have picked this up, and this might be why they're thinking that, or this person might be thinking that because of this, you know. And so you can't really judge it. You just try to learn from it and look at it from what that person has been through and why they do it. I'm not excusing it. There is, you know, really not a lot of excuses of killing mass amounts of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you have, if you want to try to understand it, because that was kind of your question, you kind of have to take that perspective so that you can start making sense of it. Because if you do that, you're not judging. You're really trying to become and understand like that person to understand what caused them to go down that path to begin with.
Right. Otherwise, it's so easy to classify the murderer as a monster and just, you know, take them out of humanity altogether and not try to understand what the motives were behind it, what the history was. So I think that's pretty typical, too, of most people, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, people, human nature wants to send them all to an island and blow it up. I heard someone say that recently. And I was like, all right, but if you send them to an island and blow them up, someone else is going to come do the same thing unless you start trying to figure out what the real problem was to begin with. So that's just a temporary fix.
Right, the preventative nature, exactly. Now, you've worked with children, correct?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so when you were working with children, did you get any sense sometimes that some of the kids you were working with were going to end up being psychopathic later on? Or, I mean, were there little telltale signs anywhere?
You know, I want to say, yeah, I can predict that, or yeah, I can't. And you know what? Kids are kids, and they're very resilient. There were kids that I saw that said, you know, these problems are deep-rooted, and I don't know if I'd want them around my children. There are people, you know, and that's human nature, but that's also being precautious, because if I'm thinking that, I'm sure that there's a danger that I'm aware of, right?
Right.
But also, you have to look at it from, let's see what people do, because if you just say, okay, they're a psychopath, and you know what, they're going to be one, there's nothing I can do, then you're saying treatment's never going to work. And I really don't like to take the perspective of treatment can't work. I like to take the perspective of it can work as best it can. It can work as best as the person grabs onto it. It can work the best it's going to be for this person. And that way I have some hope, because especially with kids, there's time to help correct these behaviors. And for some, maybe there's not. But hopefully there's time to help correct that. And I have seen some wonderful children that life was not too kind, and the path that they're heading down is going to be disastrous for them, and it's unfortunate. But if you can try to prevent it the best you can, hopefully that doesn't happen.
And hopefully the schools take note of children who are having behavioral issues like that, and they have a program where they can work with the kids, you know, with getting them off and doing some counseling with them, trying to help them as much as they can, at least planting seeds that you don't have to go down a negative, horrible road. Life can be better, but, you know, it's all a matter of choices and, of course, circumstances. When you're a kid, you only have so much control over your life, which is hardly any, but, you know, I had, as one of my guests a few weeks ago, Elizabeth Rivas, and she works with a lot of high-risk youth, and they were talking about the anti-bullying programs that a lot of these schools are instituting right now. Do you think that those programs are going to help with these issues?
You know, I was working with a school recently with an anti-bullying program, and I did see some help in that. I did see that it helped the kids, and they had this really great, you know, program with video, and they had this little puppet that they used. And for the littler kids, I saw them say, well, that's bullying. You shouldn't do that. And you know how little kids like to react things out. And, I, you know, when they got them early, it helped. And older kids, I saw that they were a little bit more likely to say something. But, you know, when teenagers and stuff are in trouble, a lot of times they just want to tell their friends, and they don't want to say there's a problem. So I think it really depended on how the program was implemented, and I think it depended on the program and if it was evidence-based. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. But just from what I've seen so far, what it's around there, it did, you know, I did see some difference in how the kids were responding. One of my students did her dissertation on cyberbullying. And, you know, it was very fascinating because she saw a whole different level of bullying that was there. And, you know, she was talking about how that's a new wave to bullying that people, you know, haven't really studied a lot about. I mean, they've studied it, but I think that there's a whole other part of culture, because our society has changed, that has started this different path of bullying rather than the bullying you see in your face every day where the kids are pulling each other's hair or fighting. You know, so I think that bullying is changing, too. And I think that may be something to look further at.
Yeah, definitely more research, because it's changed since my day, too, when I was little and getting bullied at school. And, you know, it's just, it's so much more extensive now, with especially like Facebook. Once it gets on it's just horrible. And, you know, kids just, they don't have the coping skills a lot of times to be able to deal with that properly. It's overwhelming. I mean, we've heard so many stories about cyberbullying lately and the effects of it.
Social media.
So how else do you think our society is changing along the lines of violence? Due to social media and the different changes that we've gone through over the last, say, 5-10 years?
I mean, just looking at what's going on, obviously violence has increased since, you know, the 1950s, of course. You know, but I think that video games, I mean, I see these video games, and the more violent, the more the kids want them. And they put on there for teen or for adult only, and, you know, the kids can still buy them. They can download them probably online, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then you have television messages, but you have the Facebook, like we talked about, the social media influence to that. And people put video clips in their Facebook. And so if you said, I don't want you to watch that, and your friend puts it as a video clip for their Facebook status, you've now seen it. And so that kind of stuff has really changed, you know, even if we try to police our children and put parental control, it has changed what our children are exposed to. It has changed what adults are exposed to. It's changed what the world is exposed to. But, you know, when you're shaping little minds and that's what they're seeing, that's changing how people view society and view their fellow man. And that is some of the difference that you probably have seen or we've all seen since, you know, for years ago, since 100 years ago, 50 years ago, or even 20 years ago. I mean, look how fast the Internet caught on. I mean, I grew up in a world without the Internet, mm-hmm. you know? Right. And so now that we have it, it blows my mind what kids have now.
Exactly. We have access to so much more of the world right now. And you're right. If we, you know, feed little ones violence, they grow up and think that it's normal and imprints in their brains as like, okay, well, if I'm having a problem with somebody, I'm going to just go hit them or kick them or whatever, you know, and then go up from there and start using weapons. And it cascades into uncontrollable violence and who knows what, unless it's intervened at some point. And again, it's catching people when you start seeing those warning signs. And if you feel as a bystander you can't do anything, go talk to somebody else that does have power and can do something and can intervene in behalf of that person and then other people around them, correct?
Yeah, just don't stop talking. That's the one thing I want people to get, is don't keep the secret. Don't keep it to yourself. Don't stop talking. The more you talk, the more we talk about, the more you get it out there, the more people are going to understand, one, it's not okay, but also people are paying attention, they're watching, and then the more you talk, you might talk to 10 people and they don't give the response you want. Maybe they don't know what to do, but somebody eventually is going to do something. They're going to say something. They're going to react to it, right?
Yeah.
And so the secret is what kills it. You know, you have to talk.
Yeah, exactly. Have the courage to say something and not shut down out of fear. Definitely. Again, yeah. I would like to open up the lines for the listeners. Our number is 800-893-9562. And call us up, give us a comment, ask questions of Dr. Deborah Warner. We'd love to have you on board. Also, if you would like to hear this podcast later on, through Skid Row Studios. You can download it from iTunes. It's Psych 101. That's PSYCH, the number 1-O-N, and another number 1. And there are about a dozen previous shows that are on there also. So we are here to help you. And Dr. Warner, is there anything else that you would like to say along the lines of forensic psychology? Like, how is it different from counseling psychology?
People ask me that all the time. because, you know, they see that I started off in counseling and then I went into forensics. And what's funny is that, you know, the path I took I always say it called me rather than I sought it out, because, you know, like counseling psychology, you see a lot of counseling psychologists at universities, and they counsel, it's more brief, and they really, the heavy-duty cases are not seen as much with counseling psychology, but it's just also different settings that go into that, where forensic psychology is more of a specialization. And so you're kind of trained, you train more as a clinical psychologist, but not really, because you're making sense of psychology and the law for the courts. So what you're doing is that you're going in there and saying, okay, this is psychology, and you're telling the court what that means, so you can merge the two together. So what you want to do is you want to interact in that field, but you have a specialization to do assessments, competency evaluations. You help them understand what maybe what housing unit's better for an individual, or are they really mentally ill, or are they malingering? Like, there's a lot that goes into it, but you also have all those other parts of being a psychologist that help you, and you are licensed. You can get licensed in a lot of states with being a forensic psychologist, and being, you know, it's really what type of populations you want to deal with and what kind of things you want to do. Not that counseling or clinical psychologists don't do some of those things. Forensic psychology has just chosen that as a specialization to the profession, and that way, that's mainly what they interact with. But, you know, I always tell people, in forensic psychology, you got to know a little bit of everything, because sometimes, due to budgeting, you're the only one there at a lot of government facilities. Mm. So you need to know how to navigate people to which way to go, and, you know, even though your cases are tougher, you need to know other things that go on about it. So when I got into this field, that was one of the things that drew me into it, is that I could know a lot of things, and I could use a lot of those things to help people and help a lot of people in unfortunate situations, but also help the courts understand them. And that's really why I got into this field.
So if you can speak about it, what was one of the most interesting cases that you got to work on?
You know, there are so many interesting cases. I'll speak about it generally. You know, my favorite cases are with people who are probably part of the criminal recidivist population, meaning they go in and out of jail. And I love seeing those people do well. And, you know, some of my favorite cases are the ones that reunify with their family, and you know, it's funny because some of them can't read, not a lot of them. Some of them can't read, or some of them don't have other coping skills. You know, and some of them take on substance abuse. They take on the things in their environment that have, you know, helped them support themselves. And to get someone to understand what other options they have and then to see that is absolutely amazing to me. And to be a part of that, I am so proud of that. I am so proud to see someone who has come so far and had so many damaging things in their life do well. And that's amazing. And I have had clients who I still talk to and still find me. And sometimes I run into them on the street, which is amazing to me. And to see that they're doing well, that means more to me than anything. It, you know, I would do my work for free to continue to have those moments. And, you know, and the other part of my job is I started teaching so that I can help people have those moments. And so when I see a student and the light turns on and they really get it and they really understand the concepts and then they go out and start doing the work, that's the other half of me that gets fulfilled. And if without those two halves, I'm not fulfilled, but it's because at the end of the day, I know I'm helping people who haven't had certain circumstances happen to be successful.
Yeah, it's wonderful that you're there and you can see both sides of the picture. You're helping really tough populations, instilling hope in them and the possibility of change for a better life. And then you have, on the other hand, the students that you're, you know, instilling your wisdom onto them, and they're going forth and they're helping other people too. So what an incredible career you've had. Amazing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's coming full circle, which is interesting. So, you know, I started doing some work now with NPEIV, the National Partnership to End Interpersonal Violence Across the Lifespan. And it's funny because I didn't, you know, I knew I like where I'm in my career, but, you know, I'm having so much fun working with them because it's really about ending violence across the lifespan, across everyone, across everything. And so my focus is forensic psychology. You would think that's narrow, but it get, like I said, I don't like to be pigeonholed. So it's allowed me to really expand to everything to end violence and to end abuse, and they want to stop abuse across everything. And it's really neat to me to have that perspective, because then I can work with all populations that are kind of forensics and not just one. And so in doing that, I really have come back to my roots, you know. So it's a neat feeling.
Yeah, that's great. And definitely working with, again, with working with the children and hoping to veer them off of becoming perpetrators of violence themselves if they've come from violent households is huge. Mm-hmm. I do work in a domestic violence shelter, so I definitely see the issues that, you know, for the families that are coming in firsthand, because they're coming in, you know, fresh from their, you know, the crime scene, basically. And it is really hard to do, you know, it's the small amount of work that we have to do, because they're all, it's a 30-day emergency shelter. So we try to plant seeds real quick and try to get them to go through domestic violence education classes and work with a case manager and try to get them transitional housing. And it's just, it's overwhelming. You know, and especially since they're coming in and they're traumatized, the women and the children. And I've worked a lot with the kids with attachment issues, and just getting them to trust any kind of adult sometimes is really tricky. And definitely amazing work. So you'll definitely have to keep us apprised with, now what was the name of the association again?
It's NPEIV, the National Partnership to End Interpersonal Violence Across the Lifespan. It's part of IVAT. And it's about interpersonal violence. It could even be sexual harassment. It could be domestic violence. It's about really stopping violence, you know, with people and abuse. And you know, so you can look at it through different layers and facets. And they look at both sides of the coin, too, but they also look at, you know, what also will re-victimize the victim, you know, and educate people about interpersonal violence. And that is what's really awesome, is that, you know, they want to educate and they want to help people understand, you know, they want to understand the cycle of trauma that happens out there. And so it's really about, you know, what I told you before, it's about really getting people to understand when the light goes on, and then that will stop some of this behavior. And it might help stop some of the stuff we've been talking about today, like these mass murders that happen. You know, if you just pay attention, you know, to what you're doing and causing interpersonal violence or trauma, then maybe, you know, people won't copy it or people won't do it. You know, so it's thinking about your fellow man, you know, and understanding their differences, understanding diversity to the truest sense of the form, not just black, white, green, and purple, but understanding differences in gender, and in if you have one eye or if you have two eyes, or if you have, you know, if you're in a wheelchair or not. Or diversity is about so many different things. Just having a different point of view is diversity. And so understanding that, and people having some tolerance and acceptance, that will stop some of this interpersonal violence.
Right. Instead of just looking at a person that's different than yourself and going, oh, I don't want to get to know that person. That person looks weird or scary or different from me. Yeah. And just, you know, turning a blind eye, walking away, and just, right, again, just not being afraid of other human beings.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because we categorize every day as human beings. You know, if we all look the same, and I had a wand, I said we all look the same, we would, as human beings, find that one person whose nose is just a little bit to the right. And then we say, everybody with their nose a little bit to the right, and we start putting all of these negative things on them. Or we put positive things on them, whichever, but somebody would be negative and positive.
Yes.
And as human beings, we just have to either stop doing that or accept the differences. There's really no other way to live. You know, you can have tolerance, but intolerance, you're tolerating that they're there. But also you're still saying in some ways that I'm going to deal with you, I'm going to tolerate you, but yet I'm going to do what I want to do. And we kind of need to come together and really have a sense of people, you know, people having differences and having some acceptance.
Right. Appreciate the differences and live and let live.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely. Well, as we're starting to wrap up here, is there anything else that's of interest in forensic psychology that you would like to mention?
No, but, you know, people mix this up with CSI a lot, and that's not what it is. It's not scraping under the nails and doing nail splatter. And you might be called to talk about that or talk about, you know, what kind of crime that is. But, you know, that's forensic science. And so people mix that up. But other than that, you know, it is one of the most rewarding fields that I can think you can get into, not just because I'm a forensic psychologist, but because you get to do so many different things and do so many things that are so fun that, you know, I get bored if I sit idle, and I never sit idle. I get to be on radio shows like this with you, and I get to teach, and I really get to do lots of things that are really interesting, and that's the joy in my life. So there's not much else, just I'm not CSI.
And what would you recommend to a listener who might be interested in pursuing forensic psychology?
Look online. Look at the programs. I know the Chicago School of Professional Psychology has a program. I know that, you know, Alliant has a program. There's master's programs. There's doctoral programs. There's programs all around. But really, look at it. Talk to people. Call people. Call me. I'm open to talk to people about the field. Find the right fit for you. Find the program that's best for you. And really think about if this is the field for you, because it's not for everybody, and that's okay. But really think about if this is something you want to do, and research it, and find people in the field. And then if it is, enroll. You know, I mean, we're always looking for students at the Chicago School, and so are other schools. And
it's a great school.
Definitely don't think you can't do it. Just, you know, you have to try, and you have to be one of those inquisitive people and not be a shy person, but a tenacious person. But honestly, the field has room for everybody. We have a student that is in the environment of underground video gaming, and another student I said did cyberbullying, and another one, only one, wants to work in corrections. And my husband, who's finishing his degree in forensic psychology, started off wanting to redesign prisons, and now he's doing sex offender research. Like, everybody, there's room for everybody in this field. And if you don't want to teach, you can research. If you don't want to see clients, you have to learn how to do that. But if you don't want to do it, you can go do something else. So don't think that you can't do it. You just have to try.
So it sounds like it's wide open with possibilities.
Yes, there's a lot you can do with the degree.
Definitely. And is there any tips for a listener also that... any signs for them to look up with for anybody that might be of concern that they might go into a violent path and they're scared and they want to go get help? What would you recommend?
If they feel like that, the best thing for them to do is either call 911 or check themselves into their local emergency room. If they feel that, you know, they are really in danger, or you think someone else is in danger, you know, take them to the emergency room. Call 911. Tell them where they're at. There's nothing wrong with trying to get some help. If they just feel they need to talk to someone, you know, there are clinics everywhere. Go in the phone book. Pacific clinics are everywhere in Southern California, and they have branches everywhere, and they, you know, will talk to people and help them. But, you know, talk to, if you're in a college with psychologists, talk to them. They're able to give you a referral. But just make sure you reach out. But your emergency room is the best place to start if you feel that way. And 911 for immediate response, because they will also help you with resources. There are resources everywhere if you want them.
Right. Just reach out and don't be silent.
No. And if you can Google lots of things and come up with places to go and call one of them, just call.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Warner, thank you so much for being with us. If the listeners would like to contact Dr. Deborah Warner, her contact information is D Warner, it's DWARNER, at the Chicago School, and that's one word, .edu. And her phone number is 213-615-7203. Again, that's 213-615-7203. She's here to help. If you have any questions, comments, please contact Dr. Warner, or you can contact myself at jgoode8@verizon.net. Please contact me with any questions, comments, or if you have any ideas for future shows, I would love to hear from you. And again, this has been Dr. Deborah Warner with Forensic Psychology And this is Julianne Good with Psych 1-on-1. Thank you so much for tuning in. And take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.